Miniature soldiers, big opinions. This is the Conclave Podcast.
You know, I probably should have figured out what to say for the intro before we started.
Happy Halloween, everybody! It is the Conclave Podcast, and for some reason I sound like the Count from Sesame Street! There you go. There's your intro right there.
Excellent. Okay, we have an intro. This is episode 44, I think, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. We're in the 44th millennium, and the Tau still haven't expanded out of the eastern sectors near Ultramar.
We've overtaken the story of 40K.
Excellent, but yes.
Hello, there's still no new old R models.
Oh my god. So yes, hello everyone. Welcome to episode 44 of the Conclave 40K podcast. Today, I am Quipster, and I've got with me Ed, the Sandman. How are you doing, dude?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I am knackered, but otherwise very good. And we've also got with me Adam, aka ADR Wargaming. How are you doing, dude?
Hello. I'm good. I'm all right. I'm a bit tired as well. It's been a long week.
I was going to say, you've had a long weekend doing things. Wait, does Kelly listen to this podcast?
I mean, I don't expect her to in any way, shape or form, so probably not. But yeah, we've been quite busy. We've had a fair bit of stuff, life admin to do over the course of the last week or so. So it's been a busy weekend.
Excellent. So this episode, we're going to talk about a couple of things. We literally just before this, before we press play, we decided that we're going to talk about Warhawk. Be careful for spoilers, because we will spoil the entire thing.
You know what? Whilst you did that intro, it actually just occurred to me. Why don't we do... Why don't we cover the Horus Heresy, well, the Siege of Terror, up until this point? So anybody who's listening, who just has never given the Siege of Terror novels a second thought, lots of people don't read the books, or if they want to catch up, because of course we're getting towards the end now, and they want to be able to jump in. Mm. Let's give a bit of a synopsis as to where we are. Over the course of the episode today.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I think that'll be fun.
Okay, yeah. Where do you even start with this? Jesus. So there's a guy called Horus.
this is an abject lesson, before we start, kids. This is an abject lesson on why you build your kids a statue, right?
And oh, my God.
Multiple kids, build them all a statue. Because if there's no statue... they will create a civil war that will destroy everything you love in the universe. So just bear that in
mind. We have discussed this at length. Okay, well, I'll tell you what would be a good place to start in Quipster, because I think lots of people don't know this. Mm-hmm. So let's go through the Loyalist Primarchs and let's explain just quickly why they're not at the Siege of Terror.
Yes.
That's a good idea.
If you're unfamiliar with the Horus Heresy, in the Siege of Terror, there are three-ish... Primarchs at the Siege of Terror. Okay, and this is long-standing lore. So we've got Sanguinius of the Blood Angels, we've got Jagatai Khan of the White Scars, and then we've got Rogal Dorn of the Imperial Fists, who is basically the linchpin, it seems, of the quote-unquote good guys. So let's start off then with number one.
The Lion.
Where is the Lion? In fact, well, let's do the Lion and Gilliman, because they're connected. So where are the Lion and Gilliman?
Right. So they are essentially faffing about on the other side of the galaxy.
I object to the term faffing about.
And yet, I'm not wrong.
They are sort of faffing about.
So let's put this in context. Gilliman is not faffing about. Gilliman of the Ultramarines, and we're skipping ahead a little bit here, is... pile driving his way towards Terra. There's actually a really interesting short story. I can't remember what compilation it's in, whatever. But it's a short story about Gilliman having to go through all of these Iron Warrior traps so that he can actually get to Terra. And there are certain strategic systems that the Iron Warriors have laid booby traps in and mined all the planets and all this kind of stuff just to slow him down, because Gilliman still has the most intact, largest legion, and everyone fears him. Now, as for the Lion, the Lion kind of is Faffing
I'm
about.
I'm going to stop you right there, Quipster. I'm going to stop you right there. So the lion is the opposite of faffing about. The lion is doing one of the most important jobs that any of the loyalist Primarchs are doing. So the lion is the first person in 40K to figure out, after the Emperor, that what happens in the in this universe is reflected in what happens in the warp. He discovers this when he commits exterminatus on a planet and all of the demons nearby are weakened. And so what the lion is doing is the lion is going around and destroying the homeworlds of the traitor legions. Now, what this means is that what's reflected in the warp of those planets, which then powers the traitor legions, is massively weakened, and it's actually highly hinted in the books that the reason, and you know, we're jumping ahead a little bit here, the reason a lot of the traitor legions are starting to flee is because essentially they're like, you know, warp. Reflection, as it were, has been massively weakened because of the lions. And Sanguinius actually confirms this using his magic sighty-sight.
This may sound like Dark Angels propaganda, but you know, Ed is right. The janitorial duty that the lion takes upon himself with regard to cleaning up the traitor legions, it is a valuable service to the Imperium as a whole.
However, I would also like to point out that Dorne is absolutely the most important person at the siege. Like, without,
I mean, he's in charge.
For sure. I did say I wouldn't take that away. And I will say as well, you know, in terms of the most important people for the Siege of Terror, the entire Siege of Terror is almost based around Gilliman, right? So because Dorne, throughout the entire Siege of Terror, is trying to hold out for Gilliman to arrive, and Horus is well aware that Gilliman is going to arrive. And so essentially, the bad guys have to win before Gilliman comes in and does something to their behinds, as it were.
Literally, in this case.
Indeed. But yeah, so that's number one. Number two, like, who's next? Who's not around?
Argument one out of the way.
Yeah, that's just number one done. I'm trying to think, who's next? Korax. Korax, he's another one who's not around. I've sort of jumped ahead a little bit to the end. So Korax, as far as I'm aware, he's kind of hanging out with Leman Russ right now in the timeline. He, as far as I'm aware, just couldn't get back to Terra fast enough. I think that's the story so far. And he ended up hanging out with Leman Russ, who, after Russ tried to go after Horus single-handedly in a stupid, stupid decision, they're kind of like...
Russ.
I know. Yeah. They're kind of just like holed up on a planet while he heals.
I think Korax has one of the weaker reasons not to be there in terms of like his actual reasoning. So one of the big things that he says is that, you know, it's important to protect the Emperor, Dorne. You know, they're having a conversation. So of course it is. But it's also important the Imperium know we're fighting for them. So he leaves the planet and it's like, you know, attacking supply lines, defending populations, this kind of thing as well. Which is, of course, is nowhere near as important as the task as protecting the master of mankind. Leman Russ is the fascinating one. I've joked about this before on the channel. So his thing is like, he was told by the Emperor that he'd have this like big purpose, and he was given a spear, the twin of a Valdor spear, interestingly, and they do very different things, and we don't find out what Leman Russ's does for quite some time. All we know is that Leman Russ hates the spear, and it like, you know, it gives him like weird looks, is basically how it's described. And he gets into his head that he has to try and kill Horus. Now, he's convinced he can't kill Horus. Valdor convinces him he can't kill Horus. Dorne convinces him he can't kill Horus. Malkador convinces him he can't kill Horus. And all of a sudden, he goes, yeah, but I'm still going to go. And he goes, this is where the Horus Heresy gets a bit of filler in the books, because he kind of like massively damages Horus with the spear. Like, it's really powerful. But then, of course, the writers went, oh, well, we can't have Horus below 100% power when he faces the Emperor. Like, that's the story. That's so important. It's like Sanguinius's sacrifice that wins it ultimately. And it's like, okay, so what do we do? So then they just bring him back up. And so it kind of had no purpose. It was a really great story. If you haven't read Wolf's Bane, it's an amazing book. But like, the actual general idea is very odd, in my opinion.
Well, it's... Yeah. I mean, basically, let's talk about the spears for a second. So, the whole point about the two spears is, one is the Apollonian spear, and that's Valdor's. And the other one, I don't think it even has a name in the end. It's just called the Emperor's Spear. And that, for a start, is a big deal that the Space Wolves don't give it a name, because like, all the big weapons for the Space Wolves have names. But so basically, Valdor's spear, what it
the ice spear.
No, yeah. Or the wolf.
The ice claw frost spear.
Yeah. Or the wolf wolf. Or the frost wolf yeah. spear.
The howling wolf spear of wolfdom powered by wolves.
Yeah, literally. But yeah, so Valdor's spear, the whole idea of it is that when you kill someone with it, it shows you like them. It shows you into their mind and into their soul, and you kind of know everything about them. And you think, oh, wow, okay, that's a really interesting power. Until you realize that all Valdor does with it is kill demons. And so, like, he just has horrible visions of demons all the time. And, it, you know, spoilers for Warhawk, like we talked about before, it does talk about that in Warhawk and how it affects him. And he doesn't like it. And he gets these visions, and it has, like, after effects on him, like a bad taste. And he's just like, oh, I hate doing this.
I don't know. I like the idea that demons occasionally have quite prosaic thoughts. You know, it can't all be eating souls, and you know, they must in the warp in their native environment just like go about the business in an orderly fashion. Like underneath all the horror and the carnage, Valdor must have killed the odd demon and just been like, "Man, demon shops are weird. It's strange. I just don't understand them." Oh wait, no, they're trying to eat the souls of beings, right? Okay, back to normal.
Oh yeah, literally, but. It's interesting because the Leman Russ's spear, or the Spear of the Emperor, is the opposite in that if you hit someone with it, it shows them the inner truth about themselves. And so that's kind of the whole big deal about why Russ is trying to like hit Horus with it. Because he's like, well, maybe he's been taken over. Maybe he's being controlled. Maybe there's something. So if I hit him with this spear, maybe I can, you know, show him the truth of what's happening. And he does. And he does that. And it's this super interesting moment where he, like, there's this moment of clarity where they talk as brothers and they're both badly wounded. And he says to Horus, but Horus, like, why are you doing this? Like, you can come back. And Horus goes, no, it's too late. I can't. The Emperor's a liar. And it's this, like, moment that passes between them. And it's actually, like, quite beautiful. And then everything gets undone in the next book. And then Horus is back to 100%. Like Ed said, so it's kind of like, okay.
There's no effect. Some filler episodes in the Horus Heresy, as enjoyable as it is. That's cool. I want to leave Vulcan for last, because that's probably the most interesting one.
Mm.
So who are we missing?
That's a good point.
Well, hang on. Done Gilliman. We've done Korax. We've done Leman. So, yeah.
He's wounded after trying to kill Korus.
Yep.
Oh, Alpharius, technically. Well,
okay. No, it's an obvious one that we missed.
Who?
Where is Ferris Manus, guys?
Oh, God. Okay. Well, Ferris Manus is dead.
Okay. Yeah, he died.
You could say he doesn't have a head for command anymore.
That's like a Fulgrim joke.
Yeah, I wasn't your best.
I identify with Fulgrim. He's my boy.
So yeah, again, if you're really not familiar with the Horus Heresy, there is a series of initial large betrayals, and one of the big ones at the start is at Istvan 3, and Ferris Manus fights his best mate Fulgrim, which is always one of the weirder friendships of the Primarchs, in my opinion, because they have. They like making things. Outside of that, they have very little in common. and they fight, and he dies.
It wasn't just making things, though. It was like standing around with their tops off, sweating, sort of hammering metal in a quite kind of like vaguely homoerotic, but also quite masculine fashion. It's kind of cool between them. They had this whole thing going on. Wait, you're telling me the one I downloaded from Amazon wasn't the right one?
I mean, that may have been fan fiction at this point. I'm sure there's a lot of it on DeviantArt, but especially about those two, Jesus. But but this is the thing, and this is as someone who is a fan of Loyalist Fulgrim, it really does annoy me almost that there actually isn't much literature about the relationship between Fulgrim and Ferris Manus. They're described as like best bros for life, but it never really ever shows that. And that, I think that's kind of a tragedy. Like, not at all. Even their Primarch novels, they barely talk about each other. And it's just like, what the fuck? This is not, well, Ferris, not okay.
Manus, Ferris Manus has some of the like least developed lore anyway, because of what happens to him so early. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of understandable, but it would be nice to have a little bit more on, you know, the Gorgon himself. Wait, the Gorgon?
I agree.
Yeah, the Gorgon. To get more info on him.
I've just realized another big one who's not there for kind of amusing reasons. Conrad. Conrad Curse. He's not actually at the siege.
Okay, we can do Traitor as well.
I mean, yeah, I mean, we're just talking about
Ed had a nice system of doing. We did the loyalist first.
To be fair, Quips had a plan. I then barged in with my plan, and now my plan's against you. It's kind of karma. I'll take it. There are two big Traitor Primarchs not there. So who is missing Quips?
So we're missing Conrad Kurz, and I mean, I'm looking up and down the list now. Alpharius technically isn't there, but also kind of might be.
He might be.
Lorgar is the other one that is not there.
Lorgar's not there because he's a little bitch.
So Lorgar's quite easy to explain. Basically, what happens is Lorgar, like all of the word bearers, it seems, they think they're all like the real architect of chaos. It's quite funny, actually. And basically, he's like, I think I'd be a better war master than Horus. And he tries to kind of garner support amongst the traitors. And he actually like mind... When you know the true name of a demon, you can control them. And so he actually controls Fulgrim to try and like kill Horus. Mm. And then ultimately, Horus finds out about this, beats him every way to Sunday, and you know, sends him into exile. So he is not there.
Yeah.
The Siege of Terra.
No. And also, Conrad isn't there because he got fired out of a torpedo by Sanguinius.
Yes,
in a very sort of like Acme cartoon, like Looney Tunes kind of way.
Kind of, yeah.
Fire
like,
the torpedo! Fire the torpedo!
Basically, so Conrad Kurz gets captured in Ultramar and put on trial, and obviously he's found guilty because he's a fucking lunatic, and he's killed loads of people, and so he's on this Blood Angel ship, and Sanguinius basically says, right, I can't kill you because you're my brother and I'm too nice for that. So instead, what I'm going to do is something much more humane and put you in a torpedo and fire that into space forever.
Yep.
I can foresee no possible problems with this at all.
Yeah.
Obviously, he is found. That's basically it. Yeah, I mean, obviously, he's found later on. But yeah, that's basically why he's not at the siege, because he got fired out of a torpedo.
We have jumped one loyalist Primarch, though, who I think will be a fun one to explain, which is Vulcan. So, Quipster, do you want to give... I think we can do a brief rundown of what happened to Vulcan, because it's not actually that complicated.
No.
So one of the major twists that they've done with the Horus Heresy, because of course this is like 30-year-old lore or longer even, and so they've tried to spice it up where they can with little twists that don't change the overall arc. And one of the big things that they changed is they've gone, actually, Vulcan is technically at the Siege of Terra. So this actually starts at Istvan.
Mm.
So Istvan, obviously Vulcan's on the loyalist side, and then they are betrayed.
Mm.
So, and he is actually captured by Conrad Kurz, and then things get interesting, don't they?
Yes. So it's funny actually, I read these books recently, but there's a funny thing that all of the Primarchs have like a special ability. Korax can become invisible to the human eye. Sanguinius has wings. Kurz has foresight. However, Vulcan never had a thing. And it was something that played on his mind, because he was just like, am I like broken? Am I like defective? Because all my bros have like a thing they can do, and I kind of just don't. I'm just good with technology. Like, what's going on? Yeah, turns out his thing was being immortal the whole time. And so at Istvan, he gets hit with a nuclear bomb and then wakes up later and then goes, oh, guess I'm immortal then. That's a whole thing. Cool. So obviously, he can't die. And being captured by Conrad Kurz, Conrad tries literally everything to kill him. Stabs him, shoots him, puts him in the nuclear reactor of a starship, or everything. Obviously, he doesn't die. So Conrad decides instead, I'm going to make him go crazy. And this is a quick departure, because this leads to quite possibly my favorite scene in the entire Heresy. And it's this is a spoiler for Vulcan Lives, I believe. And it's basically, you know, this ship. Basically, Perturabo has this maze, which he builds for himself. But no, first it's for Vulcan to make him go crazy. Yeah. And then they put Angron in it later. But yeah, so Vulcan's in this maze, and the maze kind of like drives him crazy. And in the center of the maze is his hammer. And the hammer has a teleport homer in it. And he's just like, yes, I can crack the hammer and I can get out of here. So he finally gets the hammer. He gets to the center of this maze, and Kurz confronts him. And Kurz looks at him, and he's, and you know, Vulcan goes to crack the hammer and use the teleport, and nothing happens. And Kurz looks at him and just goes, ha, you think I didn't know there was a teleport homer in there? You're never going to escape here. I'm going to make you go crazy. And then Vulcan just looks at him and just goes, well, there's something you have failed to consider. And he takes a step forward. It's like, what's that? It's still a hammer. Bang! Slaps him across the head with it. And I was just like, yes, yes! Best move ever. Sorry, I just wanted to say that. But yes, it's a super cool move. But yes, that happens. And eventually, he uses the teleport device, ends up in Ultramar, and he's crazy. He has completely lost his marbles. He is then, through some shenanigans, essentially kind of... He's taken out in a way that means that he can't like reanimate himself. His ability stops working because he gets hit with a dagger called the Anathame, which is the whole thing... Oh, the Fulgurite dagger, sorry. Fulgurite dagger has like a shard of the Emperor's power in it, and so it stops Vulcan's power from working. The Salamanders in Ultramar then take Vulcan straight back to Nocturne, their homeworld, in an effort to revive him. And the whole thing is he's like they're almost, it's like lunacy to go back there.
It's like, have you ever seen Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs? Right after she eats the apple, and the dwarves take her home. Basically that, but with Space Marines.
Yeah, it is literally that. But yeah, so they end up going back to Vulcan, and the captain, I think it's the equerry even, to Vulcan is Numion. And Numion ends up sacrificing himself to reanimate Vulcan, essentially through like the power of faith. And it's like a whole plot line. And then, you know, Vulcan wakes up and he's like, I have purpose. I have something I need to do. And he forges this talisman. And then he's like, right, we need to get back to Terra. And essentially they use the webway to get back to Terra. And that's how Vulcan ends up on Earth. And basically what happens is this talisman that he's created is a final failsafe that they put in the Golden Throne, which means if the Emperor dies, then it will cause a massive warp explosion, which will both destroy Terra, but also absolutely cripple Chaos for all time. And so,
it's pretty sick.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And so, like, that's the final failsafe. And then, you know, the final scene of Old Earth is basically Vulcan turns around, stands in front of the Golden Throne and goes, right, let's do this. And he's just waiting. So Vulcan is actually at the Siege of Terra. He's just kind of standing in front of the Golden Throne waiting to be attacked.
There's a pretty cool bit in Wrath of Magnus where he pops up. Where Magnus again, I mean, at this point, we won't say spoiler warnings, but Magnus makes it to the... Magnus actually gets to the throne room, basically. He goes in front of the Emperor. The Emperor sort of lets him through. I mean, that's essentially what happens. And Vulcan confronts him, actually, when he's there. And it's just a really cool, like, sort of three-way dialogue between the brothers and then Dad, you know, the Emperor, which is pretty awesome. And I'd definitely say, like, Wrath of Magnus is not a long book either. Like, it's well worth a read.
Yeah, they do a series of short books to go along with the main ones. And that's actually one of the better ones. It's really good.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, super good.
Magnus is actually in a really interesting place at the start of the Siege of Terra. So as I'm sure everybody is aware, we have Mortarion of the Death Guard, and he has fully ascended to demonhood at this point in the story through some help from Typhus, who, like... so this is the... Again, where there are some times in the books, I feel like the writers need to pick a lane and stick to it. because they love to be like, oh, but it could have been this. Oh, but it could have been this. So like in Warhawk, one of the things that's discussed is that, oh, well, Typhus really manipulated all of the Death Guard, including Mortarion. And that's a pretty big plot point that's been around for a long time. And they're like, oh, no, because actually Mortarion actually knew about that. And so Mortarion manipulated Typhus to think that he was manipulating Mortarion. And it's like, yeah, well, Typhus knew about that. So Typhus... and so it's not, there's really... Ultimately, I think the idea is that you're all pawns of chaos. So we've got Mortarion. Angron is, with the help of Lorgar, becomes a full demon Primarch of Khorne. And he has a really underrated part of the Horus Heresy when he's captured by Perturabo, because it's very hard to keep the demon Primarchs in line, and he's kind of captured through science, really. It's a really cool scene. And he's brought to Terra. And Adam mentioned earlier that they had this in the maze that they keep Vulcan in. They actually have to keep Angron in there because Angron just keeps killing everyone on the traitor side. And eventually what they do, it's literally written, they fire Angron at the planet. Because it's just such a nightmare.
I always think it's the scene in Avengers with, when the Hulk's in one of the Avengers movies, they build that big cage for the Hulk, and then Loki, I think it's in the original Avengers, right? And then Loki fires him out of the thing, big flying aircraft carrier. I've always imagined it's a bit like that with Angron, right? He's just in this big metal box, and then they're like, yeet! And they just fire him down to the planet, and he just breaks out and causes carnage.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, Angron is kicking ass. Fulgrim, originally he becomes a demon Primarch. Him and Perturabo actually have a bit of a spat over him becoming a demon Primarch. And then what happens is he goes into Slaanesh's palace and has lots of fun there. It's hinted at. And the traitors have to go in and get him out, which is not something that's easy to do. Now, interestingly, about the Emperor's Children and Fulgrim, and this is actually a long-standing lore, is that the Emperor's Children are the first to quit at the Siege of Terra.
Yep.
And they have... It's a pretty excellent scene. I'm going to talk a little bit badly about Sigismund, but I'm sure we'll big him up later on. So originally, Sigismund rocks up, and Fulgrim literally just slaps him aside. And then Dorne rocks up, and it's the quote something like, Sigismund's courage outweighs his sensibilities. Mine doesn't. And it's amazing. It's like Dorne actually beats the crap out of Fulgrim, because it's really interesting thing about Dorne is because Dorne is not described to be the best fighter at all, but he is the best analyst of the Primarchs when it comes to fight moves and how people strategize and stuff. And so he can actually beat Fulgrim, who is the much better fighter, because he just knows Fulgrim so well and he can goad him in the correct way. And he basically beats Fulgrim in a fight. This doesn't kill Fulgrim because he's a demon. Then him and all of the Emperor's Children leave because of this fact.
We don't need to be here.
It's held against them for the next 10,000 years. It's still brought up in modern day 40K. If you read a book in 40K and that's what the traitor legions are talking about, we're talking about how the Emperor's Children always quit, that's why. Because they were the first.
Because they did.
They decided there were more fun things for them to do, like making drugs out of the population of Terra, and Daddy having a fit about Dawn goading him and slapping him down was just the pretext they needed to go off and do that, rather than do important things like bringing down the walls of the palace, for example. Had to be left to the Death Guard and the Iron Warriors to some extent.
Well,
and the Titan Legions, more importantly.
So yeah, I mean, we've talked about most of the Primarchs. We talked about all the Primarchs that aren't there. Are we going to talk about Alpharius? Because that's a bit in contention.
Yeah,
it's very hard to talk about Alpharius.
Yeah,
but we can give it a shot.
So I mean, one thing we have to mention is number one: if you haven't read the Alpharius Primarch novel, oh my god, go read it. It's the best thing ever. And I'm about to spoil I'm about to spoil the shit out of it. Because, we have thought for a really long time that in Praetorian of Dawn, Alpharius died and Omegon took over the Alpha Legion. However, we recently discovered that it was Omegon who died and Alpharius is the one who survived. So, and that's revealed in the Alpharius Primarch novel. So, there is a character calling himself Alpharius who is on Terra. We just don't know if it is the Alpharius. That remains to be seen.
He is, when we're saying he is technically not at the siege, because he is on Terra and he is making his way with a group of people, but it's so Vanessa thing, and it making my way downtown, working fast. Anyway, but yeah, he's on his way, but he's not actually there quite yet. Hopefully he gets there. I kind of want to see that whole thing. I mean, it will play out in the next few books, but that, I'd want to see where that goes.
Yeah.
After the Siege of Terror, Omegon and, or what is Alpharius, we think now. This is the thing. You can read it any way you want. You like, you know, all these things are written to be like, if you want to believe Alpharius is alive, you can believe that. If you want to believe he was dead and killed by, it was actually Dawn, then you're allowed to believe that. But yeah, one of the things that's really interesting about Alpharius, which relates back to what we're talking about with Vulcan, is there's a hot, huge subplot that I'm not going to go into because it's so overdone around the Perpetuals. So it's not just the Emperor and Vulcan who are Perpetuals. The Perpetuals are a kind of, they're seen as like the next stage of humanity, and there's a whole bunch of them, and there's a whole subplot surrounding the Perpetuals. It's still not done. Holy hell! It's probably going to lead to nothing. It detracts from Primarchs and Space Marines fighting, so I'm not as fun.
It is a bit incongruous, let's be fair. It is a bit incongruous. Yeah. I am with Ed on this one.
In Legion, for example, Legion is a really odd book. So Alpharius is basically told by a cabal of Xenos species, including people like Eldrad Uthran. It's you know, hinted, it's like the Watchers in the Dark, the Dark Angels, all these like alien races. They get together, who of course are the enemy of humanity, and they tell Alpharius about Horus turning in the near future, that it's going to happen. And he said what they basically convince him to do, and he for some reason accepts, is that if he sides with the Chaos forces and helps them win, this will then mean Chaos controls, it takes over the Earth. This will mean that the Earth is destroyed. And this will, as Quip was talking about earlier, if they can destroy the Earth, it weakens the power of Chaos in the galaxy so much. So Alpharius is like, oh, I'm going to support the Chaos Traitor Legions to actually hinder the Traitor Legions. It's very Alpharius, but it's also very odd logic.
So there's actually a whole thing with that I don't think it's made particularly clear in the books, but apparently was the authorial intent. Because Dan Abnett wrote their book, he did an interview, I think fairly recently, about this. And there's the whole thing that basically the Alpha Legion are really smart, or basically they're supposed to be really smart. And their whole thing that apparently going along with the Cabal's plan was essentially them going along with it just to see, like, where it goes and how much power these guys have, essentially just going along with it to find out more information rather than them being actually convinced. But it doesn't make that particularly clear in the book. It just kind of seems like they just go along with it.
Yeah. I don't get that.
It's all a bit, you know, oh yeah, no, I was secretly working with the bad guys because I'm a good guy.
I agree.
You really get to like have it as your 40k. Like, lots of people believe that like the Alpha Legion runs everything now. Alpha Legion's behind everything in modern 40k. So if you want to believe that story, there is plenty of evidence to do so. It's quite well written in that respect.
So I kind of want to talk about Warhawk specifically for a second here, because oh my god, so much cool shit happened in this book.
Yeah, like, it's a very good book.
Like, number one, Chris Wray is probably my favorite author in Black Library. One, because he just, anytime he ever writes about a Legion or the Custodes or anything, he just gets them. He gets the core of what...
I've heard this a bit, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, like, he just gets what the core identity of that Legion is. So, like, with Death Guard, his Death Guard books are the best out there. Like, hands down. Like, Lords of Silence, like, he just gets what it means to be a Death Guard.
Lords of Silence is, like, the definitive. If you want to read about... I mean, the Buried Dagger is the origin story for the Death Guard, and it's a very good book. But if you want to know about the Death Guard today, if you're a new player, you're starting out with Death Guard, and you're like, I want to read some Death Guard fiction, read Lords of Silence, because it's a really, really, you know, Primarchs and Space Marines fighting each other is all very cool, but actually the like ground level view of your average, well, not your average, but a Plague Marine who's been around since the Siege of Terror, and he's seen everything. You know, he's been there, right? That is pretty cool. And you get to see that perspective in that book. So I think you're definitely right. Like, Chris Wray does write.
Yeah.
That when he gets into an organization or a character group or whatever, he gets into them really, really well. And you learn a lot more about them. It's not just as cool as the the constant battles are. It's not just the like, we must fight over here. Oh no, now we must fight over there. And this is all that happens. Fighting is good. Yes, fighting is good. But dying is bad. Yes, dying is bad. This is our character development. You know, it's a lot more interesting than that.
I agree. And like, one of the best examples of that he's done is the White Scars. He's turned that legion from having fuck all lore to do with it at all to one of the most rich, deep, and interesting legions out there. And like,
they're also really cool. They're just really cool.
They're so cool. And especially with Jagati as well. Like, the Primarch of the White Scars is Jagati Khan.
Hang on, Cripstead. Before we move on, we have to settle on how we're going to pronounce.
This is a good point.
His name for the rest.
Normally, I say Jagatai.
So I would say Jagatai.
I always thought it was Jagatai. Yeah. It is inconsistent. Like, one of the things that's quite funny is even in the audiobooks, they're not consistent with names. It's quite funny. Yeah. They don't have like a spreadsheet or whatever. But we're going. Yeah. Are we going with Jagati? Is that what we're going to go with?
No, Jagatai sounds better.
I would say Jagatai because it's Mongolian inspired, right? Like Kublai. Mm. You know, Shiban Khan, obviously in the book, right? It's that kind of Mongolian style, like steppe peoples sort of. I would have said Jagatai is like the way that is. I don't know. I'm not an expert, but I would say
I agree with you.
Sounds right to me.
I'm with you.
You can. I mean, at the end of the day, like you say, Saman, it's your 40k. You can call him Jagatar, like if you whatever you want, you know. But we'll call him Jagatai for the purposes of this podcast.
Yeah,
I agree.
Okay, sorry, Cripster, carry on.
Yes, so they really delve into the character of like what it means to be, they call him the Warhawk, Jagatai Khan, and one of the things that essentially earlier I talked about, every Primarch has like a power, and they have like a thing that they do. Interestingly, like because there was so little ever written about the White Scars, they essentially made that their power. That they made that Jagatai's power. He's constantly underestimated. Mm. His power is that he's a mercurial person. You don't really know where he is. And I love that they really juxtapose the White Scars against the Death Guard, because the whole point about the White Scars is they're all about movement, they're dynamic, they fight and they're very fluid. Whereas the Death Guard are the exact opposite. They're stoic. They don't move. They're the immovable object. And so, like, pitting them against each other is this, like, super interesting fight between, like, diametrically opposed forces. And that is sort of reflected in the final Primarch fight between Mortarion and the Khan. And I love that fight for one reason. And it's just, like, the swagger that the Khan has over Mortarion the entire fight. Because all he's doing in this fight isn't just to beat Mortarion. He's doing it to prove a point. And his point is basically, Mortarion, you're a fucking idiot. And I love that.
Jagatai is the master of goading in 40k. I was talking earlier about how, like, what's fascinating about the Siege of Terror is that, and the Horus Heresy, is that there's all this old established lore and they've had to expand on it or make little tweaks. And one of the things that we've never known, in fact, two things we can discuss today. Number one was who killed Khan, because as in the other Khan, we're going to talk about two Khans today, as in the World Eaters Khan, because he was always said to have died at the Siege of Terror and then been brought back by Khorne because he was just such a cool guy. And then the other reason was, why was Jagatai Khan never on the Vengeful Spirit? We never knew why this was the case. So what happens, Cripster?
Well, we're going to talk about why this showdown is happening between these two legions in the first place. Basically, the White Scars basically go after the Death Guard because the Death Guard are occupying the Lionsgate spaceport. Now, the Lionsgate spaceport is super important, especially to the Khan, because the Khan realizes, right, when Gilliman gets here, we need a very quick way to get the Ultramarines down to the surface so they can actually fight. And the best way to do that is through the Lionsgate spaceport, which they have lost. So the White Scars launch a surprise attack against it and try and take it over. And more than that, there's this whole thing that throughout the entire book, they talk about everyone being under this, like, sort of blanket of despair, I suppose you could call it. It's like almost like a psychic... It's like a psychic duvet of despair. So you got the alliteration in there.
Even Dawn is feeling it. They explain that quite clearly.
He starts to get to the point where he's like, we are actually, because he's always, throughout all the books, there's always been this thing with Dorne where he's like, we can win. If we hold, we can win, right?
Yeah.
Because Gilliman will come, the Lion will come, and they are coming, and they're going to get here, and we will win that way, right? We might end up fighting around the very inner core of the Palatine, right? We might end up in controlling an area no more than a couple of kilometers. But it doesn't matter, because if we do that and they've not got through and basically killed the Emperor, we win. And that's the way it works. And that is Gilliman's plan from the beginning. Just bleed the traitors, hold them as much as you can, fall back when you have to, and you know, keep fighting them that way. And throughout all the books, he's always had this thing of kind of quiet confidence that he's going to get through. Mm. And in this book, as you say, it's one of the real defining things about Dorne in this book. He starts to come out with... And they talk about, you know, his thoughts about maybe Gilliman won't get here in time. In fact, I don't think Gilliman will get here in time. I think this might be it. I think we might. I think this is going to come down to me, Valdor, you know, and the boys, basically, with Dad in the throne room and against Horus and his legion. And that's what it's going to be. It's going to be the big fight.
Yeah.
And we might lose that. And if we can kill him, that's the best we're going to do.
That's an interesting thing as well, because we have all this lore that we know the final battle takes place on Horus's flagship, but it never occurred to me before this book was written that none of the loyalists think that's how it's going to go down. All the loyalists think that the final battle is going to be in the Emperor's throne room, because of course that's what you'd think. Like, why would you assume that they were going to teleport onto the Vengeful Spirit? Like, at this point in the siege, it seems like a really... like nonsensical thing to happen. And it's interesting as well, because like this, like, we're going to call it the duvet of depression, the psychic duvet of depression affects Dorne to the point where not only is he, like, you know, like Adam said, like beginning to suffer from like despair essentially, but his mental faculties aren't there. Like, he can't he literally can't think straight. There's a bit where he describes, like, I'm so tired now that I don't even know the names of the people who are walking in to the command center. And I should, because I'm a Primarch and I don't forget things. And you're just like, oh my God, what is happening to Dorne? And it turns out that this psychic duvet of despair is being projected. TM. is being projected by Mortarion from the Lionsgate spaceport. It's become essentially the psychic focusing rod for despair. And that is something that's really helping the traitors.
Like Milton Keynes in our world. Or Luton.
Precisely. Yes. It the Lionsgate spaceport is the Luton of
Luton
the...
Luton Airport. It's the Luton Airport of the 40K universe. The psychic for pure despair.
We should also like add the caveat of like Luton, like the place, not the famous Warhammer YouTuber. We quite like him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we mean Luton, not Luetin.
So, Warhawk. Basically, Jagatai is the only Primarch, and seemingly like the only person who realizes what's happening here. He realizes that, you know, Mortarion is projecting this despair blanket onto, you know, the palace. And he's like, right, we cannot let this happen, or we actually will lose. So they launch this surprise attack against the Death Guard. And it's super hard fought. Like, they lose a lot of guys. And Jagatai realizes, right, this is going to have to come down to me and Mortarion, because it's all emanating from him. And it culminates in the final duel between the two of them. And it's almost symbolic in the way that it's presented in so many ways, because basically the Khan looks at Mortarion and he looks at him and says, you're weak. And you're weak because you fell to chaos. You had every gift. You were given everything. You were given the strength. You were given the most amount of strength and endurance out of any of the Primarchs, and you squandered it. And he's basically trying to teach Mortarion this lesson. And so he purposefully, almost, in fact, completely purposefully, lets himself get beaten the living shit out of.
Oh, yeah, Mortarion kicks his ass like for most of it.
Oh, my God.
I will say, that's one thing I really like that they do. Like, I talked earlier about Fulgrim, Dorne being Fulgrim, and that was well done. One of the things they do in the Primarch fights that I quite like is it's actually not always the good guys that win. Like, you know, they never let the Earth be destroyed. but often, you know, like the power level between Mortarion and Jagatai is now quite large. Like, to Chris's point earlier about the gifts of Mortarion. Mortarion is like War Master level, like, ability in the Primarchs. And there's not many of them that are. So, and now he's got all the demon gifts. So, yeah, it's quite cool that they did it this way.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. And it's really interesting because basically Jagatai basically lets himself get beaten the shit out of. And not only that, but he's also goading. He's goading Mortarion. Like, there's one point at which he goes... Yeah, like, there's one point at which he goes, like, why do you wear that stupid mask? You've never needed it. It's just an affectation. It's just a fashion statement. And he then gets clocked in the face. There's another bit where he just goes, you stink. It's just like, what? Yeah,
it's like, you smell bad, buddy. And it's like, okay.
Yeah, and Mortarion's just like, this is just embarrassing now. And he just punches him in the face. Like, just, why are you doing this? And it's all to prove a point, because then basically the Khan looks at him and just goes, yeah, but I just took it. And Mortarion's like, wait, what? It's like, I took every beating you could give me, and I'm still standing. And I did it to prove that you're weak. Because you couldn't have done what I just did. And the Mortarion's just like, well, fuck you then. And this is the point that I love, because this is the point where we find out what the Khan's Primarch ability is. Because we know, like, he's constantly underestimated and stuff, but we don't know what his physical ability is. And his physical ability is that you don't quite know where he is, so you just miss him. And so it goes into this whole thing of the fight between them, where Mortarion's swinging for him and he's like 3 inches short every time because he can't quite judge where the Khan is.
He's like too quick. It's almost like an illusion that he's there. He's like 2 steps ahead of you constantly. It's such a good fight scene.
It's really genuinely fantastic. And it goes... the line of the entire fight is that Mortarion says to the Khan, you know I can't die, right? And the Khan says, yes, but I can. And in that single sentence, he just he explains everything as to why he's going to win the fight. Because Mortarion knows he can lose, so he's not on edge in the same way that the Khan is. The Khan knows he can die, so he's fighting with literally 100% of everything he has, whereas Mortarion isn't quite. And that's why Mortarion loses.
I don't know if I would describe it as Mortarion loses.
Yeah.
So we haven't actually explained. The way the fight ends is basically, I don't know. I don't know if I would accept quite as much that Jagatai lets Mortarion beat the shit out of him. I think Mortarion does genuinely beat the shit out of him. But Jagatai is smart enough to know that he just has to wait for the opening. And then basically he waits just until Mortarion's guard has dropped.
Not just till his guard drop, just till he's... He's like physically exhausted.
Yeah. As he's delivering the killing blow to Jagatai, he basically stabs him back. And it's a double KO, basically. So Mortarion gets sent back into the warp. You can't just come back out. So he'll be in the warp now for another 500 to 1,000 years. And Jagatai is basically described as dying. But then all of a sudden, it's a ship mistress who's like a very well thought of in the White Scars. She's very well connected to the Khan, and she can basically sense that he's still alive. And so he is kind of dead for the purposes of the Siege of Terror, but alive for the purposes of him potentially returning to the story of 40K.
I was going to say, I wanted to give a shout out, so it's really nice that Ed has brought her up. But Ilya Revalian is one of the unsung heroes of the Siege of Terror in this story. She is Departamento Munitorum bureaucrat, basically. She's a logistics specialist who got assigned to the White Scars and became, you know, good buddies with Jagatai Khan. And she helps basically coordinate the whole attack on the Lionsgate spaceport in the first place, because she just gets every like tank, every vehicle she can get from the Imperial Guard, every bit of ammunition from like the armies, all get to basically build up the White Scars to be able to go and do this one last attack. And I will just say, the run-up, as cool as the fight is, and as cool as the Sigismund Khan fight is that we've talked about, the run-up to the attack on the Lionsgate spaceport itself is so damn cool. these guys use an orbital plate, so one of the big space stations that's been sort of sitting underneath the shield of the Imperial Palace, obviously, so it doesn't get bombarded. They take the last one and basically use it like a big flying shield themselves to avoid the bombardment from orbit, and drive underneath it in all their land speeders and all their bikes and all the tanks and everything, and this thing just goes along above them like a big giant metal umbrella, basically getting attacked by the Death Guard, getting shot, and then just smashes into, ends up getting destroyed, and that is what gives them cover to go and do this massive like vehicle based attack on the Lionsgate spaceport. And I can you imagine, I mean, even if you're a Death Guard, even if you're a Plague Marine with all your filthy power, you are stood there and you are just watching the entirety of what's left of the White Scars Legion plus an orbital plate come at you plus the Imperial Army. Oh, you're gonna be like, yeah, I think we might have a few issues here, guys.
You have actually just hinted at another big thing we need to talk about there. I mentioned before that we never knew who killed Khan the first time, and we actually find out in the Warhawk that it is Sigismund. Sigismund is basically the founder of the Black Templars. He is the first captain of the Imperial Fists, and him and Dawn don't get on for a couple of reasons. one of the main ones is that Sigismund is like the first space marine to start viewing the Emperor as a god. And basically, this is one thing that is, you know, a big animosity between the two. And it's quite sad, their relationship, in a lot of ways. And then in this book, Dawn kind of accepts him for what he is.
He doesn't even kind of accept him. He just basically says, "You are my son. I unleash you."
And basically what happens is then some servants of the Emperor turn up and give Sigismund a big black sword, which is something that apparently the Emperor made a long time ago, or had made for Sigismund a long time ago, and is only now bequeathing it to him. And it's even said to talk to him a little bit. And then this is basically the first righteous rampage of the Black Templars. And it's very, very cool. And Khan is caught up in that.
So I actually love this. Like, what's his face? Not Lysander. Oh my god. We were just talking about him.
Sigismund,
that's it. Oh my god, I just went a massive mind blank for a second there, which is bad because, you know, I collect Imperial Fists. But Sigismund, basically, he's one of the POV characters for the book. But there's one part, one bit of the book where another POV character kind of steps up, and he's a Sons of Horus captain. He's one of the top captains. Of the Sons of Horus, and you just think, oh, where's this storyline going?
Oh, yeah.
And basically, what Sigismund is doing is he's just hunting down traitor champions and captains just because he can. And there's this whole big storyline where the Sons of Horus captain is like going along, and he's like, right, I'm going to earn some kills here at the siege, because, you know, this is the end of days here, and after the siege is finished, everyone's going to be asking, what did you do at the siege? Who did you kill? And, you know, I'm one of the top captains of the Sons of Horus, so obviously I've got to kill Sigismund. So he has this whole thing that he's going to run around, he's going to kill as many, you know, Templar brethren as he can, and as many Imperial Fists. And he comes up upon an ambush of Templar brethren. And he's just like, right, okay, I'm going to do this. And then Sigismund just kills him just on a whim, just without a second thought. Funny. And literally, I think it was another Imperial Fist captain turns to him and goes, oh, who was that? That was a Sons of Horus captain. Do we know that guy? And Sigismund just goes, who cares? I honestly don't give a shit. And then he just walks off.
Isn't his name Achaon?
Something like that.
Something like, because my favourite bit, it doesn't matter. He's irrelevant. My favourite bit about Sigismund in that book is what he says after the Khan Barney, which I'll we'll call it, happens.
The Khan,
which is when one of the other Templars says to him, he says, you know, oh, this is a great victory. You know, you've killed the first captain of the World Eaters. Like, this is a huge deal. And Sigismund just goes, no, I'm not done. Until I get
great,
yeah,
and that's he just comes out and he just says, when I get a badden, then I'm done, and it's just like, wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him.
So like, I love the reasoning behind that though. Is basically like, yeah, well, basically all of the old guard who are actually good at this are dead. And so, like, Abaddon's the only one left, so I have to kill him because the rest are just pretenders, essentially.
There is more to it, to be fair, because Sigismund has been told by one of like the first saints, basically, of the Imperium, is that his legacy is to kill Abaddon, the first captain of Horus Lupercal. And, you know, really fun side projects. This actually goes all the way into just before 40K, well, 9,000 years or so before, because he sticks to this for like 1,000 years. He waits outside the, after the Siege of Terror, he waits outside the Eye of Terror. I always thought it was funny how those two have the same name. Anyway, he waits outside the Eye of Terror for like 1,000 years for Abaddon, and then eventually they have a fight. And I'm not even going to say spoiler because it's very, very old lore. And that is how Sigismund dies, because he's basically, you know, he probably would have beaten Abaddon back in the day. He is said to be the premier swordsman, but he's just very, very old at that point. And it's actually really, really quite emotional because you don't read the fight in Black Legion, but you do read Abaddon's reaction. And Abaddon is genuinely sad to fight Sigismund because he's just so well respected. He's a very, very cool guy. We have got to talk about Abaddon briefly. He doesn't appear in Warhawk. However, he's very important to the Siege of Terror. One of the things that fascinated me about the Siege of Terror is that Abaddon already at this point has kind of almost turned his back on Horus. I thought the story of Abaddon is going to be that after the Siege of Terror, after Horus is killed, or, you know, obliterated, as it were, at that point, he, you know, falls into a pit of despair and eventually decides upon that he must himself become Warmaster. And that is not the story in the Siege of Terror. I don't know if I just misunderstood that for years ago, but this is basically what they've done is said that, look, at this point, Abaddon is kind of a good guy and he does believe in like brotherhood and he does believe you should forge your own destiny. And he can just see that his father is just this warped, tainted thing that is nothing like the father that he once loved. And Abaddon really hates chaos. You know, he really hates it. And so he has actually already starting to turn his back on all of the traitors and all of the traitor marines. They explain this in Warhawk, are now starting to see Abaddon already at the Siege of Terror as one of like the true leader of chaos. One thing we haven't mentioned, is that before that, Perturabo was kind of leading the show. And one of the things that's fascinating is Perturabo just ups and leaves in the previous book. He basically goes behind his back to commit a plan, you know, without Horus's knowing. And then Horus is like, oh, actually, I knew about this all along. And I, you know, knew this was going to end in a humiliating fashion for you potentially. And then Perturabo is like, oh, screw you then. And so he leaves the Siege of Terror. So he's gone. And now Abaddon is basically, because Horus is in the warp most of the time fighting the Emperor. So Abaddon is the lead figure at this point. The reason I mention this is because one of the major theories that's flying around at the moment, and I'm sure we'll talk about theories maybe later on, is that Abaddon is going to be the one to let down the shields on the Vengeful Spirit. And yeah, it's really interesting. The development of Abaddon, I've really enjoyed, because it's so important. It's so important for what 40K is. And he's not just like this background character that they then go, oh, and now he's important because everyone else is dead. He's actually important in his own right. I think that's pretty great.
Yeah.
Well, Perturabo, I mean, you're right about his sort of eventual reason for breaking, as it were, right, in terms of the whole, you know, the fail, the sort of humiliating failure of the plan thing. But he does go on a sort of similar journey almost to Abaddon, right? Like he does have the... He says a couple of times in the previous books about the fact that, you know, Horus is no longer... And it's quite an interesting theme, actually, throughout... Some of the other traitor primarchs have similar thoughts, right? They say, like, well, Horus is no longer, you know, what we knew. Like, he has become something else. You know, yeah, he's no longer Horus. He is this thing that's become something different. And is that good? I don't know. Maybe it isn't. I mean, even Mortarion in Warhawk talks about, like, well, what comes after... You know, what comes after the siege? What comes after we win? Because at this point, he sort of thinks they're going to win, right?
The reason I actually really like that comparison you've made there, Adam, about Perturabo is because the big difference between Perturabo and Abaddon, which is where, and we don't know why this happens, it'll be written someday, whereas Abaddon sticks to this into 40k, Perturabo is going to make a 180. And because as Adam says, like, you know, Perturabo is pretty disgusted with what Horus has become, and yet, you know, at least the old lore is that Perturabo is now a demon primarch. And so at some point, he ultimately fools himself, and we don't know how or why that will happen. We know it's to do with the Iron Cage, big battle with the Imperial Fist, essentially. But I'm so interested to see what happens there.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
So what are other big plot points, do you think, that you think people need to know? I have one, but we'll circle back to it, that we need to know. I guess Sanguinius, actually, just thinking off the top of my head, is one. Adam, you're a fan of the Blood Angels. What is Sanguinius doing now? We've talked about Dawn quite a lot. We've talked about Jagatai. So what the fuck is Sanguinius up to?
Well, so Sanguinius has been, he's been at the siege since the beginning, really. And he has been fighting amongst the Blood Angels. There's a very, very, very cool scene where he basically one-shots
a ton, God, that was good.
Which is awesome. And he's, being Glorious Hawkboy and flying about. But he's also plagued now. He's having more and more of these visions of his own doom, basically, that he is sort of now cognizant of the fact that he is going to die. And as sort of Crypster alluded to earlier, at this point, I don't think they're sure whether this is going to happen, where this is going to happen. I think the assumption is made, as you say, that the final battle will be in the throne room with the Emperor. And that is where Sanguinius will die, at the hands of Horus. Basically, he knows that's going to happen. He knows he has to sacrifice himself for something. So he's quite an interesting character, because he gets quite morose about this, because he sort of knows that this is going to happen. And this is going to be something that he just cannot avoid, and he sort of needs to step up and just accept it. And I think he's quite sad, more so because he's, his legion, who he loves dearly, he's going to lose them effectively, because he's not, he'll be dead, he'll be gone, and what fate belongs to them is their own. I would say, if you're into Sanguinius and the Blood Angels, do read Fear to Tread, which is the book about the earlier on in the Horus Heresy. There's a sort of subplot where the Blood Angels get lured away, or get told that Horus has turned at this point, but they don't know that. They get told to go via some ever so trustworthy word bearers to this Cygnus cluster, which is an area of space which is sort of quite a way out on the edge of what is the Imperium at that point. And they're told to go off and sort of deal with some issues there, because there's some sort of problem. And they basically end up fighting a load of demons. And it's Khorne's sort of attempt, or the Chaos's attempt, to turn the Blood Angels, in alliance with some greater demons of Slaanesh as well. Kyrus the... I can't remember his or her full title, but it's Fate, like Kyrus Weaver. The something or other. No, because Kyros Fateweaver... So Kyros Fateweaver is the Tzeentch Lord of Change. This is Kyrus the Perverse, I believe, which is a keeper of secrets, a Slaaneshi keeper of secrets. And basically, her and this bloodthirster sort of hatch this plot to try and turn the Blood Angels, and it does sort of work for a while. The Blood Angels go absolutely nuts and just start murdering everything. But then, and Sanguinius gets severely injured actually fighting.
Carbando.
Oh, of course. What's his name? Kabanda. Yeah, I was gonna say, I'm saying the bloodthirster is Kabanda, the bane, the angel's bane, in many ways. But then he sort of comes back from that, and eventually they win. But it's the story of the Blood Angels kind of coming to terms with their true nature and what they are, because obviously he knows about the Red Thirst before this. I mean, the Black Rage isn't a thing at this point, but he knows about the Red Thirst, which is this sort of madness in combat and drinking the blood of your enemies and all that sort of thing. That's an interesting backstory. But yeah, at the siege, he is fighting. He's out fighting the traitor legions, but he is coming to terms with, I'm going to die. So he's going on his space Jesus journey, basically.
So I will say, talking about that as well, that last, basically before the White Scars go and attack the Lionsgate spaceport, Sanguinius and the Khan have a final conversation with each other, and it's so emotional.
So sad. Yeah.
Like, they're both thinking, like, this could be the last time we ever talk to each other. And the Khan is thinking, because, it might be the last time we ever talk, because I might be about to die.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think it ever really occurs to him that Sanguinius might be the one who's going to die, but Sanguinius
thinks exactly. The same. Yeah.
And, like, as the audience, we know both sides, and so we're all just like, oh, no! Oh, God! And they have this heart-to-heart with each other.
And I think there's even a bit where, like, because I love, this is what I live for, is those moments. And I think there's even a bit where even Dawn is like, I would have liked to have talked to the Khan.
I would have just liked to talk to.
And it's like, it's just so sad. Yeah. It's just so, so sad. I will say, one of the things about Sanguinius, and it's a bit odd, because, Adam, exactly as he says, he kind of has, like, panic attacks in the Siege of Terror, almost, to the Hara Primarch level.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting is, because I was surprised they did that in the Siege of Terror, because in Maelstrom, he takes it head on because he can see the future and he plays out the fight against Horus, I think like a million times or something. And he does actually realize in one of the realities he can actually beat Horus. But if he does so, the cost to humanity is greater. And so he actually completely resigns himself to dying. And then exactly as Adam says in the siege, he's all like, oh, do I have to die? It's like, we've already done this, Anguish. But I will say the reason this is really important is because the biggest event is yet to come, which is, of course, the Emperor Valdor Dorn on the Vengeful Spirit and what happens there. But of course, the other major event to happen from long-standing lore, which we assume will be in the next book, is Sanguinius's moment, second moment, which is him holding the Eternity Gate alone. And this is, you know, as literally like all of the Blood Angels are starting to fall. And eventually it's like just Sanguinius left. And he is just keeping back hordes and hordes of demons by himself. And then he has one final fight versus Carbanda and wins that historically. Yep. I mean, that is probably the thing people are most excited for. I will say, and this genuinely is sad, one of the things we didn't get in the Siege of Terror, which was long-standing lore, was Jagatai Khan riding a rhino.
Ah, okay. I have something to say about this. So, okay. So, there in the afterword of Warhawk, I don't think... Did you guys both listen on audiobook?
I can't read.
Yes.
So...
Yeah, neither of us.
I actually don't... The first time I read Black Library books, I always read them on Kindle. And so the Kindle has the afterword written by the author. And so he, like Chris Raitt, actually goes through all of that because he says, right, here are the beats, the story beats that the White Scars need to go through. And one of them is Jagatai Khan on top of the rhino riding out to meet the hordes. And he's just basically he alludes to the fact that, well, we needed a reason why, you know, Jagatai Khan wasn't on. The Vengeful Spirit with everyone else. We find out at the end because he's been battered to a pulp and he's healing, so he physically can't be there. However, that means that he's the only one, the only Primarch, who's still on Terra when things are happening. So, the riding out on top of the rhino is probably going to be happening simultaneously while they're on the ship.
So you don't think Jagatai is actually fucking out of action? You think he's going to come back?
Oh yeah, 100%, he's coming back. Like, he's in the healing chamber.
Yeah, okay, interesting. I didn't know he was going to come back before the siege. I didn't know that.
That was my reading of it anyway.
No, fair enough. As we say, it's your story, Quipster. That's what happens in your story. It's fine. Okay, so what about you guys? Were there any other big plot point? I think we've done a pretty good job, I'm not going to lie. Is there anything else that's big that you think people might need to know?
Well, I liked the very last bit. So after you get the whole Jagatai-Mortarion fight and the consequences thereof, and then him being rushed off to Malkador to be healed, well, presumably to be healed, there's one last bit, which is it Shibban Khan or is it Jangsai Khan? I can't remember which one it is. The guy who we follow in throughout the book, it's basically he takes command of the White Scars in the Lionsgate spaceport.
It's Shibban Khan.
It's Shibban, yeah, okay, who's such an awesome character. Throughout the rest of the books as well. But he sort of gives a speech to sort of rally the White Scars, and he makes the point that they are there to do a job. Like, for everything we've said is true. The Lionsgate Spaceport being a big pylon of despair is true. You know, that they've destroyed that. That's a big help. But the other thing they allude to throughout the book is that when the Iron Warriors, because they were the ones that actually took the Lionsgate Spaceport in the first place, they didn't dismantle a lot of the weapons in it because they were going to use them at some point, they thought. And likewise, the Death Guard didn't. So there are a lot of very big guns. Guns that are pointing into orbit. Yeah. And he makes the point, he says, we're going to do what we're here to do. Load the guns. And the book ends. And that's it. Or he says something to that effect. Like, load the guns or prepare the guns. And it's just, it's like, right. So, because obviously one of the big plot points around the Siege of Terror is, well, look, the whole of Terror is surrounded by this vast fleet of traitor ships, right? And we've had a couple of incidents where people have got through. So Corswain brought basically a detachment of Dark Angels through by bringing the, one of the Emperor's sort of mega battleships. He had three originally. He sort of uses one of those and smashes it through the traitor fleet and then sort of comes in by drop pod and Thunderhawk and Storm Eagle. They sort of get into the palace. But there's still this huge fleet there. And for them to win, right, they also, as well as needing to kill Horus, they also need to start getting rid of some of these traitor ships. So now they've got a bit of firepower and they can start shooting back, which is going to start giving them. And bear in mind, the traitors are still landing stuff. They're still landing transports and stuff on the planet. They're going to now have that. And I thought that was actually a really cool, like, okay, so now I see where this is going. They're now evening the odds even more, which is then explaining why they hold out for, you know, however, I don't know how many books. Do we know how many books we've got left?
Two left.
It's just, they've still got to hold out for like one more book before we get to the real end game, right? So we now know how they're sort of going to last that long as well, which I just thought was like, I was like, oh, what a line to end on.
Oh my God. So the last two books we've got left are Aaron Dembski-Bowden and Dan Abnett's going to be writing the last one.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I can't even begin to describe how excited I am for this. Because, like, Dan Abnett has written one of the two best Siege of Terror books so far. Like, Saturnine was outstanding.
It's incredible.
Can't wait to see where they go with it. But basically, the thing we didn't touch on yet, and they talk about it, Chris Raitt talks about it in the afterword, is the fact that Sigismund has changed. He has gone, because, like, in the earlier books, they all talk about Sigismund like he's this, like, a jovial warrior, like he laughs when he fights, he's such good humoured.
He ain't laughing no more.
No, he has completely changed. And it's remarked on by Khan during the fight, because during the fight, Sigismund is completely silent. He doesn't say a word. And this actually kind of freaks out Khan, because they're like actually very close brothers. And so Khan is just shouting things at him like, why won't you talk? Why are you being so, like, basically, why are you being so weird about this? This matters, this fight. And to Sigismund, it's just another fight in an not unwinnable, but in an endless series of fights. This is just another one to him.
Well, one of the things that I find fascinating about Sigismund's change in the way he approaches things is he actually says in the book that he no longer sees Dorne as a father. He sees Dorne now as the demigod son of the emperor. That father-son bond is basically gone, which is interesting because I was always fascinated to know what Sigismund would think of Dorne after, because Dorne is, by all accounts, broken after the Siege of Terror. But now he just, you know, he doesn't see him as dad. He's going to take the Black Templars and go crusading. But he does start seeing them all as gods now, which is cool.
Yeah, which makes, you know, sense from his perspective. And it's interesting as well because it's funny, because during the fight between Khan and Sigismund, Khan looks at him and says, I can see clearly he's physically bigger than the last time I saw him because he's swelled with the power of chaos. And so Khan has just completely given himself over. And yet, during the fight, it's Khan who looks at Sigismund and says, you've become a monster. Because he's had such a change in mentality that Khan is the one who's freaked out during the fight. Not Sigismund.
Yeah. It's kind of funny that Mr. Angry, the man who could, like, I mean, you say he talks to Sigismund, and he does, but it's like they very much make clear that it's like, spitting through, like, so, you know, frothing, clenched teeth, because he literally is so angry he can barely talk.
Yeah, literally. But yeah, I love that imagery of like an absolute lunatic nut job who's fallen to chaos, turning to one of the loyalists and going, "No, you're the monster." Just because of his new altered perspective on... Essentially, this is the turning point where 30k becomes 40k. It's not like a time difference. It's a change in mentality. Just because they realize, no, this fight is forever now. There's no golden age. It will never happen. And so, yeah. Yeah, it is. But, you know, kind of cool.
I think one other thing, actually, while I was talking about Sigismund, just briefly, before we talk about the most important thing, which is, of course, the Dark Angels, is just to expand a little bit more on religion in the Horus Heresy. So, again, and I never knew this before I read anything to the Horus Heresy, but the idea of, like, the Emperor being a god is started in the Horus Heresy, not just because of things like Lorgar, but the actual, like, cults, they start to spring up in the Horus Heresy. And, yes, it's already a pretty big thing, and it's actually started to yield positive effects. Malkador and Dorne aren't really sure what to do about all the religious people because on the one hand they condemn it, but on the other hand it is really helpful because if you believe enough in the Emperor you can become invulnerable, you can summon lightning and all that fun stuff. and even a lot of the key characters in the key guardsmen in the Horus Heresy have started to, you know, believe that the Emperor is a god, and saying the Emperor protects works, apparently. And the other thing I think is just really fun to mention is the other thing that it started in the Siege of Terror is the Inquisition. This is a bit of a side point, but Dawn starts the Inquisition basically by accident. The symbol for the Inquisition, if you're not familiar, is the symbol of Malkador, Sigilite, and so everyone kind of assumed he started it, but actually they just needed a symbol, and so they're just using that because it gets you into places, right? And basically Dawn starts it up because he's like, look, someone has to chronicle what's going on here in case we win. You know, as Adam talked earlier before, Dawn used to think they were going to win, and so it was like, someone needs to chronicle this. And so he restarts what is called the Remembrances, which is what becomes the Inquisition. It's a really interesting little side point. It's so fun, things like that they throw into these books.
And that is why, ladies and gentlemen, you don't let historians get too much power, because they will turn into an organisation which will torture you for information.
Yeah.
Well, best way to record the info.
So let's move on and talk about the most important thing, which is, of course, the Dark Angel. So I mentioned before about Vulcan, you know, now being at the Siege of Terra, this is a huge deal, right? It's a huge change. Like, one of the big theories, well, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this towards the end, which we're vastly approaching, I can see, is that, you know, people think that maybe Vulcan will join Sanguinius at the Eternity Gate. And maybe nobody sees this. This is maybe this is why it goes down at the Siege of Terra. We see this kind of thing all the time. So one of the things they address is like a side plot in the book is Alianus Piers. Is that how you say it, Cripster?
Pius.
One of the old stories of the guard is that a lone guardsman stands between the Emperor and Horus. And actually, it turns out that this is a fabricated exaggeration, because there was a guardsman called Alianus Piers who just continually exaggerated about himself. And that eventually becomes like, you know, canon lore to the guard. It's quite funny. Anyway, one of the things that has changed is the Dark Angels are now at the Siege of Terror, headed by Corswain, who is... Even if you're not a Dark Angels fan, if you have a favourite Dark Angel, it's probably Corswain, because he is, by all accounts, a good guy and does some really cool stuff in the Siege. He stabs Conrad Curz in the back, most notably, and he spends the rest of the Horus Heresy chasing Typhus through the warp. Eventually, Typhus makes it to Terra, so he kind of makes it to Terra too. And the Dark Angels do have an important purpose in the Siege of Terra. At this point in the Siege of Terra, the palace is obviously the main holdout. We then have the remaining White Scars, who are holding the Lion's Port, who need to hold it so Gilliman is able to land and bring some relief to the palace. And the other thing that's really important is the Dark Angels have recaptured the Astronomicon. And this is a really big deal, of course, because if it's not relit, Gilliman might not be able to find his way back to Terra. And there's not many Dark Angels there. There's like 10,000, which is not very many for Legion numbers. And so, yeah, that's what the Dark Angels are currently doing. But they might all die. Maybe that's why they're not chronicled. They'll probably come up with a funny reason or interesting reason as to why it's never recorded that the Dark Angels are at the Siege of Terra. Because, of course, this is something that's held against the Dark Angels, you know, to this day. And so it's really interesting. And the other thing that isn't in Warhawk, but Mortis, is they have hinted that there is somebody with the Dark Angels who shouldn't be there. Now, one of the biggest... Yes. Oh, you missed that bit. Basically said it like that. And one of the big things, as personally, that I am most excited for, probably post Siege of Terror, but maybe before, is we still don't know officially who Cypher is. And so one imagines that what they're going to try and do is have a first hurrah of Cypher, whoever that is. We still don't know. So it could be something to do with that. There are, of course, fallen in the Dark Angels, so the Dark Angels at Terra have got traitors amongst them. I look past that part, but still. it's fascinating. We don't really know where the storyline is going. We know they have to hold the Astronomicon so Gilliman can make it. That's another big change in the story.
Yeah, it was pretty massive, right? Because, as you say, it was just accepted for years that they just weren't there.
But also, like, it's funny, you know, we joke at the start about, like, you know, the idea of the Dark Angels faffing about, and this was always the historical lore, and they kind of came up with this cool reason as to what the Dark Angels were actually doing, and they were doing something of importance. Quipster. It's really interesting how they've done this, and pretty much all of the legions are important to some degree in the Horus Heresy. But yeah, I guess if there's nothing else anyone wants to talk about before we wrap up, Should we talk about like theories people have? I know you have some big ones, Quipster. Or things you're looking forward to seeing or anything else you want to mention.
Okay, so, I mean, big theories for like what's going to happen during the siege. I think one of the biggest ones that I've heard so far are that, number one, Sanguinius falls to the rage during the fight with Horus and kills him, and the subsequent fight is between Sanguinius and the Emperor, and Sanguinius fucks up the Emperor and is in the process killed. That's one theory, which would be interesting.
That would be like a monumental reveal, wouldn't it? Like if they did that.
Oh my god.
And it's quite funny, these things. You know, we always talk on this podcast, we talk about like theories and we love a bit of like theory, you know, sit around conspiracy theories, get my little cigarette out, sit around bonfire, talk about it, yeah. Like all that kind of thing. We love those conspiracy theories. And one of the ones I love about that is one of the reasons people give for, in some way, whether it's because he falls or because of some other reason, that it's the Emperor that kills Sanguinius, is that in the artwork, people argue that his armor, where he's been stabbed, looks like he's been stabbed from behind, because it's kind of burst open from the front. So people are like, oh, it can't be Horus, because if he was fighting Horus, Horus, like, you know, hits him with the claw from the front, right? But it's the sword coming through the back. So we know that GW likes to sprinkle little, you know, like I'm doing a sort of Salt Bay movement, that gimp thing there. They like to sprinkle their artwork with
another enemy of the podcast.
Because he won't.
I'm
let
sure
us
he's an avid listener.
Mediocre steak for £800. I mean, if he was, that'd be hilarious. They like to sprinkle their artwork with reveals. You know, there's this whole thing of, you know, nothing that's shown in the artwork. However, the slight problem I have with that, the reason I'm a bit skeptical, is that artwork is yonks old. Like, it is old, right? So I find it hot. And they plan things on long scales. We know GW plan things on a 5 to 10 year time scale, at least, right? It could happen, but that is like early, early days. So who knows? Who knows? Believe or don't. It's up to you. This is called the flat Sanguinius theory, by the way.
So yeah, that was my contribution to that. I don't know if you guys have any theories about what's going to happen.
I mean, the one I'm most enthused by that you said it earlier is the idea that it's Abaddon that drops the shields on the vengeful spirit.
It's a very popular theory.
Yeah, it's a very popular theory, and it's one that I could get behind. It's one that would make sense, because I think it's going to be interesting to see why, if it's Horus, why does Horus do it? Is it hubris? You know, is it like, I'm going to have the final confrontation, or I'm on the verge of losing, I need to kill the Emperor, I need to lure him up here? Maybe it's that, which is kind of
the
way.
That's the old
Yeah,
idea,
that's like the old lore. But yeah, I don't know. I do like the idea it's motivated by something, you know, something more interesting than that, you know.
So genuinely, it wouldn't surprise me is if the shields get dropped because Gilliman has just turned up in system. And so he drops the shields to lure out the Emperor because he's just like, this is it. Gilliman's here.
It's like the Gambit.
Like,
that's the old lore, yeah. I'm with you. I am what you would call a basic bitch when it comes to Warhammer 40k lore. And I want it to happen exactly as it should happen in my head. And so the only reason I don't like, and this is quite a niche reason, but if you're not familiar with Horus Heresy at all, there's a quite important character called Loken, Garvial Loken. And he was one of Horus's most trusted advisors. He was what's called the Mournival, which is the four kind of members of the Sons of Horus who advise Horus Lupercal. And he is loyal to the Emperor during the betrayal and basically makes his way back to the loyal side. Long, long story short. Dies somewhere in the middle and then comes back to life. And I love this character so very much because he is for me, and I think a lot of people have this when it comes to Horus, and I know I certainly do. He is just like my first. He's like the first Space Marine I ever fell in love with. Just like, I know Horus isn't the best written character, and I know that, but he's the first Primarch I fell in love with. So I will never not love Horus.
You lost your transhuman virginity to him.
I 100% is. And one of the things that is important in Garvial's storyline is he loses a fight versus Abaddon and is basically killed. And I want the final battle of the series to be the Emperor versus Horus Lupercal and Abaddon, and then Garvil Loken turns up. And then they do a nod and they go, let's 2v2 this. But I want Abaddon to lose. And because Abaddon's strength as War Master isn't because of his martial prowess, although he is a good fighter. But he is swelled by the powers of chaos post Horus Heresy. So I want him to lose to Garvil Loken. I want it to be Garvil Loken's death that is the final thing that makes the Emperor kill Horus. Because that's another huge thing, right, that we still don't properly understand, and the Old Lore never properly made sense. So I'm sure they're going to think about this a lot as to how this happens. Is that in the Old Lore, it said that the Emperor, when he has the crap beaten out of him by Horus, and when something happens that makes him realize that his son is gone, this is not his son anymore, and he obliterates Horus with a thought, like a spear shot that goes through the chink in the armor that Sanguinius has made. Now, that implies to me that he could have done this at any point, but he couldn't bear himself to kill his son. So what is it? We still don't really know that thing. What is the thing that makes the Emperor go, you know what, the son that I loved? And I do believe the Emperor loves his sons. I'm sorry again, basic bitch, but I do believe the Emperor loves his sons. And so I want to know what it is. I want to know what it is, because I don't believe the death of just another guardsman would do it for him. I think seeing Horus Lupercal kill one of his most beloved sons, I think that could be enough.
Yeah, like that's the straw that breaks the
That's my theory.
Yeah. That's cool. I like that. That's actually really nice. I think that'd be good to see that.
Yeah. I mean,
which is why it won't happen.
As fascinating as it would be to, I don't know, maybe Abaddon and Horus will have a fight, and then maybe Sanguinius will die, and then I don't know. Maybe all this stuff will happen. But I just hope it goes down as I want it to.
Yeah. I mean, inevitably, what's going to happen is it's going to be some third thing that none of us have ever conceived of. And we're all going to go, oh my God, I can't believe they went there.
Wasn't there a thing, I think you might have told me this, Clips, wasn't there a thing of like the author said, oh yeah, someone has guessed it. Like someone has guessed what's going to happen. I mean, which, to be fair, makes sense, because there are so many fans of the 40K. We all think about it a lot. Of course, somebody at some point has gone, what if it's this? And that is the answer. And hopefully, they don't do any complete 180s and just like undo 30 years of story.
Yeah, so, I think
they're limited.
Yeah, because I think the only author who's actually active in any way on social media is Aaron Dembski Bowden, and I think it was someone on Facebook said to him, like, does this happen? And that is what happened. And I think he just had to lie about it and just go, oh, no, you're being ridiculous. But no, apparently the guy guessed it, I think. I might be making this up, but it would be a really funny story.
Someone told me that once. It might not have been you. I had a feeling it was.
I mean, there's only so many permutations, right?
Yeah, right. Like, you know, the Emperor either loves his sons or he doesn't, or they'll leave it a mystery.
The Emperor, it turns out the whole thing was like, it was a dream of a guy in a shower, like the whole entire plot of like the first three scenes of Dallas.
Yeah. Oh my God.
We mentioned before about the POV. I wonder who the point of view is going to be from in that story. Because I kind of feel like you need to have something from the Emperor's point of view, because he has to have that realization. It's quite hard to have a realization through the POV of a third party.
Well, this is the thing. They've actually never done the Emperor's point of view ever on purpose. Even in Master of Mankind, they were just like, no. Everything is people reacting to him. So they could do like Horus reacting to the Emperor.
Yeah.
Like, that's the way they could do it.
I wonder if they'll keep it like that, because I think one of the strengths of the Emperor as a character, right? Because at the end of the day, the Emperor in this story could be a really... and some people may think he is, but could be a really boring character, because he's just like the guy who's really good at everything, right? He's like the ultimate dude, you know. Whereas actually keeping it as kind of like, oh look, he does make mistakes, and whether they are intentional or not is, you know, up in the air, and seeing it from that other person's perspective is what kind of, I think, keeps him, that mystery about him is what, and like we get teasers, we get tidbits, we've had a lot more through the Horus Heresy and Siege of Terra about who he is, where he comes from, but the keeping the mystery about the Emperor is one of the strengths of the character. So actually, yeah, I think maybe, but I mean, and also, you know, let's take what Ed said as what he wants to happen. If that happens, imagine your
Games Workshop, if you're
listening, Horus's POV. Yeah, if you're listening, Greenswatch, but imagine if you're Horus and it's your POV, right? And you slay Garvial, right? And you sort of really pause. And what if you have the thought of like, wait, what have I done? And then you see what's happening with the Emperor and you think, oh shit, what have I done? And then poof, that's it. You know, you're done.
Oh, that's, you know,
that would be quite cool, right? That moment of realization of just like, because the other thing about the Chaos Gods as well is, let's not forget, they're pretty fickle, right? The point at which, obviously, they back Horus as the key to destroying the Anathema, to destroying the Emperor. I would imagine at the point at which they think, oh, he screwed this up and he's done, there could be quite a cool thing of their just the power just leaving him, right? He just goes because they give, you know, they sort of take it away from him. You know,
that's interesting.
And that's what does it. Like that is just him. And he and for that moment just before the Emperor entirely destroys him, maybe there is that one moment of just like, no, I am still your son, and I'm sorry. And then that's it.
Oh, that would be a gut punch.
And then what gets the Emperor is not the physical damage, but the grief of what he's had to do. There we go, guys. Siege of Terror completed.
Oh my god. Wow, okay, that would get me. Okay. That would really get me. Incidentally, one thing that we totally skipped over at the beginning of this was hobby progress. It's one thing we've got to... Yeah. I thought so. Basically, in the chat and the little side thing here that we've got, Ed has just gone, oh, we should talk about versatile terrain. So I was going to do like a quick segue into hobby progress. Yes, versatile terrain. So yeah, basically, Keith from Versatile Terrain, we had a quick chat with him, and he's decided to essentially sponsor us because he's an absolute legend.
Imagine if he goes, well, I was going to sponsor you guys, but I was about to start the Horus Heresy. And then you spoiled the entire thing before you actually...
also in great detail. I feel like if we're going to do this, we need to do this like other podcasts do their sponsorships. So, if I may.
Please do.
Here at the Conclave podcast, we love giving character to our models. And we love just bringing out that individuality. And the best way to bring out that individuality is a nameplate with a personalized name, your own symbols. And where can you get something like that? Versatile Terrain. Just go to versatileterrain.co.uk. It is .co.uk, right? Oh, I just got that right.
It is. Yeah.
.co.uk, and you can find a series of nameplates in all sizes and all shapes to fit your models, whether from Warhammer, whether from Titanicus, or other game series. You can include different fonts, different names, and different symbols to really personalize your style and bring it out on your models. So head over to versatileterrain.co.uk now.
Okay. I've got an idea for this. Every week, Adam has to do essentially the same thing, but in a different accent.
the only reason I did it with the sort of generic American voice is because I listen to a lot of podcasts, and they always do the here at Podcast X, we love how to make websites. And the easiest way to make websites is Squarespace. Blah, 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 you know, all that stuff. So there you go. I've got a ready-made advert for Versatile Terrain. But no, do get their stuff. They're really cool.
I'm going to do this in a bit of a simpler way, because the true difference between us and other podcasts, it must be said, is that we do all use Versatile Terrain quite a lot.
We have done for years.
So
that wasn't clear. So I have the nameplates on all of my Genesis cults, and when I've talked about Genesis cults before, you'll know my favorite thing about them is the number of characters that they have. And it adds so much to the army to have these names. I love that. When I take out my army, people see the names. They have that little chuckle. It's really cool. And I've now started to move on to add them to my Tau too. I've also got to say, they are incredibly reasonably priced. It does not cost much to get them done for all the characters in your army. So seriously, check them out. I mean, this all came about because Quipster is such a large fan that he became quite good friends with Keith. Yeah, and Adam's actually done his entire sister's army. So
I was going to say, we need to talk about that for a second.
Yeah, my entire sister's battle, they all have individual names that I put together, and Keith very kindly was able to help me in getting some nameplates together for them. My entire sister's battle army is named. And I will say, to your point, Ed, it is really cool when you get that reaction from people. You know, not they just look at your army and go, oh, that's a nicely painted army. But then they look at the nameplates and go, wait, are they all individually named? You're like, yeah. Like, that's awesome. Like, people really enjoy that, I think. So it's a really nice way just to add, you know, you don't have to go that far, but just like add character to your army. And also if your models do cool things, like, you know, if your Gene Stealer cult Magus does something really cool in a battle, give him a name. That way you'll remember it.
Oh, well, as you bring that up, I got the perfect example. So I had to choose the name the month. And Quipster, you were like this. So I was trying to think of a name for him. Mm-hmm. And I, obviously, as a Gene Stealer cult player, I like a lot of them to have creepy names. And I was like, oh, and I was trying to think of something.
You didn't call him Quipster, did you?
No, I did think about calling one of them Quipster, but no, I was going to call it a synonym for Quipster. Anyway, I was thinking of names, things that were creepy, and then my girlfriend, oh, what about like Crypt? And I was like, oh, that's cool, but that kind of implies he's more like a necromancer. And I was like, boom, that's it. That's the lore of this Magus is that he is a necromancer, but he can only perform necromancy on vegetables. he can just bring vegetables.
Is this the Primus you've got, which is doing the carrot? Oh my god!
So Quipster helped me paint this Magus that's got like this flowing carrot. You'll see it on my Instagram if you go check it out. And so yeah, then you have this is exactly what happens. You get a nameplate like this, and people go, "Oh, Crip." It's like, yeah, well, because it helps me generate my own lore.
Yeah. It's also practically good for things like if you're playing Crusade, bit of bookkeeping. You remember which characters have done which things. If everything has a name, you know, even if your sergeant in your squad has a name, you know it's like Jeff's squad, then it's easier in order to do your bit of bookkeeping. So there are very good practical as well as less practical reasons why these things are really good.
Well, not just that. If you look at the specialist games like Necromunda and Kill Team, having names for your models actually is very, not just flavorful, but like actually, again, useful for the game because it's a single squad essentially and they all have individual like stats and stuff, so like having the names really kind of does help.
Agreed.
The funny thing I like is that when I've played with my Gene Stealer cults, of course, so Gene Stealer cults are quite a rare army, you don't see them very lot, so a lot of people I play don't know the names of the characters. I just refer to them as their names when I play them. I think a lot of people must leave games with me and still have no idea why anything's called because I haven't actually told them. I've just gone like, oh yeah, that's Cousin Mum. Sorry, that's...
Oh, that's Spud.
Yeah, exactly. So they still have no idea why anything's called today. It's quite fun.
I genuinely will say this. Spud is my favourite character in all of 40K. Like, forget Gilliman, forget the lion, Spud is my favourite. Just because his lore is bonkers.
We haven't actually spoken about Gene Stealer cults and Custodes at all.
At all, and they just came out.
Because everybody knows how much we love Custodes, and everyone knows how much I love Gene Stealer cult, but that's how much we love the Horus Heresy. It eclipses a lot of stuff. Like, this is the most fantastic time, as Grips was talking about earlier. The fact that we're coming to the end, it's just magical. It's the best time to be a 40k player ever. Like, the hype is...
Well, I was going to say, I mean... They're gonna on the Custodes Gene Stealer cult stuff, because these codexes are gonna be the next ones out. We are gonna hopefully start getting some more rules previews on Warhammer Community, and obviously we can talk about that. If you'd like to hear us talk about just the Gene Stealer cult Custodes and what we think is coming, what we'd like to see coming on the next episode, do let us know. Do DM us on Instagram on the Conclave account or on our individual accounts. Drop a comment when we post about the episode. Just let us know what you'd like to hear us talk about, and if there is anything else from the Siege of Terror, from the Horus Heresy, or any other bits of lore or anything you'd like us to talk about or you think would be fun for us to discuss, then let us know, because we're, as Ed says, we love it and we love talking about it.
Yeah, we were talking about before the podcast started about like spoilers and stuff and what people think about this kind of thing. We've tried to stay away from spoilers, but then it's kind of occurred to us that most people that make Warhammer content don't really shy away from it, and that kind of makes sense. Yeah. Most people are going to read the books, or then not. Some people will have a queue, but most people, that's kind of how they operate. And so I think that makes sense. So let us know how this feels for you, because obviously there are a lot of series that we've all read and we would love to talk about more, but have some pretty major spoilers for 40K. So we can do this kind of thing more lore stuff. And also, we have got to mention, go wish Quipster good luck, because he's actually going to Snow Retreat Legends at the weekend. So... that's so exciting.
Yeah.
I don't know if you talked about this on the podcast.
I don't think I did that much.
All the names
but,
you do, and this is a genuinely one that's worthwhile.
I haven't done it. But so I'll explain really quickly what No Retreat Legends is. But so basically, SN Battle Reports are a YouTube channel based in Gibraltar, and they're famous for doing these big tournaments. They're like invite only. So No Retreat traditionally has been, you know, you have to send pictures of your army, it has to be a certain painting standard, or, you know, they've invited some of the top creators in the world. And so they created this new No Retreat Legends tournament, and they've only invited the top YouTubers and content creators in the world, and me for some reason.
It's the throwdowns you want to see, like, isn't it? It's like Lawrence, yeah, the Table Tactics, Steve and Box, the Tabletop Titans guys, you know, Winters. It's all the names. It's very, very cool. And literally, SFBAT reports are absolute legends for putting this on.
Yeah, it's going to be super cool. And like, it's been really funny, actually. So there's an SN, there's a No Retreat Legends WhatsApp group. And I've got to say, the banter in that group is absolutely lethal.
Is there some solid smack talk? I was hoping there'd be some smack talk, right?
Oh my God, there is.
We should say as well, because the time this comes out, if you're not doing anything on the weekend, it is being streamed. In fact, if you are doing something, yes, cancel those plans. So you might need some quips. I imagine they'll put the cooler people on stream. But if Dexter happens to play one of them, then maybe he'll get on stream. So do go check them out. They'll be on Essen Bat Reports on YouTube. Me, Adam, and Rich will all be watching from home.
Wishing you
me
luck,
get man. Murdered.
No, you'll be all right.
Believe we should also say Rich was on stream from Goonhammer. I think Adam and Rich are going to talk about their experience at the Goonhammer Open. But you can go watch Rich. We'll put a link on the Instagram or something, I think. I don't know the top of my head.
Yeah. That's the other thing we should mention as well. The whole point about, you know, SN getting all of these content creators over, like essentially the famous faces in the hobby, is because this is a charity tournament. You can donate to the charity that SN are going to donate to. I can't remember which one it is specifically.
I'll look it up.
I think I can't remember the name of it, but as far as I'm aware, basically what this charity does is they help the families of people who have taken their own lives, because that's part of, you know, that kind of care gets forgotten sometimes. So it's a fantastic cause, and if you want to donate to that, the details are of the Just Giving page that they've set up are on their Instagram and I believe their YouTube channel. And I think you can donate in the stream as well. It's totally worth it. And man, I can't wait. I'm gonna blast this on my Instagram as well, like the charity aspect of it too, because this is one thing that the Warhammer community, I think, is really good at. When we need to donate to something, we do kind of just rally behind it, and we're like very good at that as a community. And it's kind of that wholesome part of the community I really enjoy.
Yeah. So I was just gonna say they're raising money for Jib Sams and the Walking Together Foundation, which are both like Gibraltar-based charities they've done a lot of work with before. So it's a really, really good cause as well, guys. So if you do want to go and shout abuse at Quipster via the medium of super chats, right? We don't condone. I mean, I guess we do, but we do condone a little bit of friendly banter to Quipster. But it honestly would be for a good cause. So do go and help that out, because that's, you know, it's amazing just to support charity and stuff.
Right. Can I just say, when I unprovoked Winters came on this podcast and had a go at me, right? I did nothing to do. And I got zero support from the listeners of this podcast. So I expect the same for Quipster. Thank you. No, secretly, outwardly, I'll be mocking you, but secretly, I'll be support, hoping for you to win, mate. How great would it be if you do just like crush everybody?
Oh my, that would be absolutely hilarious, because I've seen the lists, like Lawrence, the Tabletop Titans guys. I don't think they got the memo that this was like a charity thing, because they are here to kill.
Oh no, I love this way. I think that, you know, if you want to just take your most beautiful army as you are, that's perfectly fine. But I want them all. I want to see Stephen Box and Lawrence and Brian Pullen and, you know, all of these amazing players vie out for, you know, like, because it's only fun. Oh, yeah. But I want to see it happen. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's true.
I'm so excited for those games. I'll watch all of them. Mm-hmm. I can't wait. And of course, your games. Can we say who your first matchup is? Because if you've got BCP, you can see
We don't know yet, because doing the draw on Monday.
Okay, well, I was going to say, I don't think this episode will not be out by the time that, or this episode will be out after that has happened. But I was going to say, I quite like the idea of Pardo stood there with, like, you know, when they do the football draw, just like holding a little ball up.
Yeah.
Quipster versus Stephen Box. It'd be like, ooh.
Oh my God. And you know what? It's funny. Like, I'm actually in the Vanguard Tactics Academy, and I had a chat with Steve, and he was just like, mate, when you get your pairing, let me know, we'll have a call, and we'll like discuss what your strategies and stuff can be. If it's my pairing against him, fuck.
Yeah. Yeah, and what are you taking, Quipster? Just for fun, for the competitive listeners. What's in the list? What's the bulk of the list?
So the bulk of this list is 9 Alaris Terminators.
Yeah,
as per usual.
Chunky.
However, I did do something because I recently did a bat rep against Pleasant Kenobi, total name drop, which is on YouTube right now on his channel, and I highly recommend it because we got some cool footage in that. But yeah, in that bat rep, I realized, yeah, I don't need a squad of 9. I think a squad of like 4 and a squad of 5 is enough. So yeah, I've gone for a squad of 4 and a squad of 5.
I think this is awesome, right? Because you've got your two plays, right? You've got your two plays. You got number one, which is you deep strike them all. You put targeting characters on them. You put double shooting on them. And then, like, I don't know, maybe you could just play against Steven Box and you'll just get super lucky and you'll wipe out like 3 sisters characters and you'll be in a great spot. Maybe that's what happens. And number two, of course, which we all want you to do, is just every game, without fail, you unleash the lions every
single game.
I'm here for that.
Well, now I'm going to have to do that, aren't I? Regardless of context. Just like, okay, it's the beginning of the movement phase and turn one. Unleash the lions!
people on stream be like, why is he doing this? And be like, well, the Conclave told him to, so...
Literally.
That's really cool. That's really cool. I think, you know, probably should wrap up now, but I think, like, do check it out. Is the stream just going to be on SN's channel?
I think it's going to be on SN Battle Reports on YouTube.
So if you don't know who they are, go over to it. I mean, they've got really cool battle reports anyway, so go check them out. And Pardo's a, you know, friend of the podcast and has commented on our stuff. So do head over there, do check out SN Battle Reports generally, but do check out those streams. And, you know, don't forget, if you do feel like donating, please do, because it's all for a good cause, particularly in service of shouting at Quipster to do Unleash the Lions, it seems. Let's make that our thing. You know what, Conclave, if you want to make us happy, if you want to send some stuff to a Quipster, just randomly do some super chats and just send him Unleash the Lions at random moments of the game. Do that for us, yeah?
Oh my God,
you good with that,
yes.
Sandman, yeah?
That works.
I love that. But yeah, I think on that note, we should round out the show. So yeah, if there's anything you guys want to chat to us about, we're all on Instagram. You can find us as well on Instagram at theconclave40k. We post this podcast in all places you can find podcasts. Was there anything else I need to mention? I can't even remember. We all do all kinds of things these days. No? All the things. Okay, well, in that case, I have been Quipster.
I've been ADR Wargaming.
I've been the Sandman. I didn't know we were doing this.
Oh, yeah, no. This is,
the Quipster just made.
But, yes, anyway, awkward goodbyes. Goodbye, everyone. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. Bye-bye. Happy Halloween.